Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. A few weeks back, we had a special podcast debate on whether or not Christians should have fought in the U.S. War of Independence. This was part of a series that I like to feature every July 4th that examines the role that religion played in U.S. history. And even beyond those July 4th special editions of Research on Religion, we have also published a number of other historical examinations of religion in America, including Tommy Kidd talking about the Great Awakening of the mid-18th century. One of the names that always seems to pop up during these interviews is that of Jonathan Edwards. No, I'm not talking about the North Carolina senator who tried running for president twice during the first decade of the 21st century, but rather the preacher and theologian who had a profound impact on American religious life in the 1700s. To quote today's guest, Jonathan Edwards was an activist, preacher, contemplative, missionary, philosopher, and theologian. He will be remembered for all these and more. But his most enduring legacy will be the theological vision that in profundity and influence has led many to regard him as the greatest religious thinker in the history of the Americas, unquote. The scholar who wrote that description and who will help us understand the theological vision of Jonathan Edwards is Michael McClymont, a full professor of theological studies at St. Louis University and co-author, along with Gerald McDermott, of The Theology of Jonathan Edwards. Professor McClymont has also written several other books, including Encounters with God, An Approach to the Theology of Jonathan Edwards, which won the 1999 Brewer Prize from the American Society of Church History. He also wrote Familiar Stranger, An Introduction to Jesus of Nazareth, and Embodying the Spirit, New Perspectives on North American Revivalism. All of these books will be linked on our homepage, so please visit us at www.researchonreligion.org. I should also note that Michael is more than just scholarship. Since 2005, he has served as the program coordinator for the Global Day of Prayer in St. Louis, has been the founder and current president of the Institute for World Christianity, and is a guitarist, singer, and songwriter for the blues rock band The Pneumatics that had the distinct privilege of opening up for Chuck Berry. Mike, welcome to Research on Religion.
Good to be with you, Tony.
Hey, this interview is going to focus on the theologian Jonathan Edwards, but before we get there, you actually have a pretty interesting background that I want to probe a little bit further than what I revealed in our introduction. Your curriculum vitae says that you earned a Bachelor's of Art in Chemistry from Northwestern University before heading out to Yale to get your master's in divinity. How does one go from chemistry to theology?
Well, I guess in some ways I'm like Edwards, because Edwards, of course, had a natural science interest and was interested in philosophy and theology. My mom was an artist. My dad was a businessman. I guess I've had broad interests. My first job out of college, I worked for one of the men that built the atomic bomb, David Breslow, who was with Fermi when they created the first nuclear reaction. So I really enjoyed, I loved scientific research, but I felt like I was using just a part of who I was. And that's when I decided to go to seminary. The scientists thought I think I was crazy. But
yeah, well, I could imagine that. How did you become interested in Jonathan Edwards, by the way? Was it you just felt some kinship with him because he does science, you do science, and that whole divinity connection?
Well, I did encounter him when I was a graduate student at Yale Divinity School. In fact, in our refectory, the cafeteria there, there's a portrait, there's a copy, it's not the original, but a copy of the one portrait was done from life. It's called the Badger Portrait of Edwards. And so I kind of, while I'm eating my mashed potatoes and meatloaf, you know, night by night, looking at that portrait of Edwards. But then I did a course with David Kelsey, who's still at the Divinity School at Yale, on the Reformed tradition, and he centered on three great thinkers in the Reformed or Calvinistic tradition of theology. One was John Calvin, second was Jonathan Edwards, and the third was Karl Barth. And so I got kind of stuck with the guy in the middle, because I thought, there was less interesting work on Edwards than on the other two.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and then you, in terms of Calvin, you wouldn't have to learn French or anything like that, too. So
that's right.
That makes it,
yeah,
and you're at Yale.
What's that?
And you were right there at Yale because Jonathan Edwards is a big deal
Jonathan
at Yale.
Jonathan Edwards College is there. I'm going to be there actually in a few weeks. I'm going for research fellowship at the that's connected with Yale University for the fall. I get to write the second largest university library in the world, so kind of a scholar's paradise. Good place to
Research. Well, that research kind of helps you win all those prizes. I mentioned you won this thing called the Brewer Prize before, and I have to ask this too. Did the receiving that prize, the Brewer Prize, did that come with a case of beer?
Well, you'd think I don't consider Anheuser-Busch to be beer. That's what's brewed just a few miles from me here, so I guess I'm a beer snob.
Okay.
I prefer that European stuff, but no, unfortunately, it's just the name and not something that I have to pay for my beer.
All right. Just had a check on that. Hey, let's get to Jonathan Edwards, though, who, when I read in the introduction, you called him an activist, preacher, contemplative, missionary, philosopher, and theologian. Now, we're going to cover all those as we talk about him a little bit. But I need to know what one of those words means, because I get missionary, I get philosopher, I get theologian. But what is a contemplative?
Well, the usual pronunciation would be contemplative, or the accentuation would be contemplative.
It's
a term that's more common in the Roman Catholic context. Of course, I'm in a Roman Catholic university, but contemplative, I mean, the dictionary definition would be a person who's primarily devoted to prayer. But there's something a little deeper than that. You might distinguish between knowledge and insight, let's say. That there's intellectual knowledge, but there's a deeper level of knowing that comes from prolonged meditation on truth or on God. I mean, you read the lives of the great mystics of the centuries, and there will have moments where of lucidity, where everything seems to connect within their mind. And I'm convinced that in Edwards' life, his prayer life and his intellectual explorations were very closely connected with one another. Those weren't two things. He didn't pray in one place and then go and kind of do his academic thing, but they sort of fed on one another. So as he was praying, he would have ideas and thoughts that would occur to him, and sometimes he jotted down just little shorthand notes that he later expanded into notebook entries. You might compare him to St. Anselm in the Middle Ages, who came up with the famous ontological argument for the existence of God. If you look at that closely, it's actually a prayer. It's in the context, and it's published as the title is Meditations. And in his meditation, he's praying to God and saying, well, you're so great, God, then perhaps perhaps nothing can be greater than you, and therefore, because there is nothing greater than you, you must exist. And anyway, it's an elaborate argument. But Edwards was like that, where his, you know, the adoration of God and the exploration of intellectual ideas about God were united with one another.
Very cool. Now, I also learned a new pronunciation for a word, contemplative.
Contemplative, yeah.
Okay, good. See, I'm one of those guys who does drink the mass-produced beer, so I can't pronounce all those fancy theological words there. So, hey, let's start us out with Jonathan Edwards by telling us about his upbringing. He was born in 1703. What was his child like? Did he grow up in a religious household?
He did, and he came from a family where there were generations of ministers. Of course, in his day, you know, the blacksmith's son grew up often to be a blacksmith. You know, preacher's sons grew up to be preachers, so that it was often understood, not always, but that people would follow in the vocational path that their forebears had taken. So his father was a minister. Of course, his grandfather, whom he succeeded when he was in his 20s as the pastor of the largest congregation west of Boston, that was in Northampton, his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, was this venerable figure. In fact, he was such a powerful preacher and so revered by the people that the Indians, Native Americans, referred to him as the white man's God.
Uh-huh.
As far as they could tell, people actually worshiped this man. So his grandfather was really quite famous. Father, not quite as well known, but just a very meticulous and faithful minister, and who took a lot of care in raising his son to follow after him into the ministry.
Now, he came from a pretty big family, right?
Right, 10 sisters, right?
10 sisters and one son. Wow, that must have been a challenge.
Yes.
So, what kind of education did he have growing up? I imagine as a preacher's son, he had pretty good education.
He would have been tutored by, you know, by his own father in the classical languages. Of course, in America, just as in England, of course, at this time, those who had access to education would have focused on reading Greek and reading Latin classics. And that was essentially the, the primary and secondary curriculum prior to going off to college was to learn Greek and Latin and be able to decline your Latin verbs. So he was trained by his father. He was never very comfortable with his Hebrew. In fact, even toward the later in his life, he said he wanted to improve his Hebrew. Mm-hmm. He started quite early in the languages.
And so was he tutored at home, or were there schools around this time that were doing that?
Well, he would have had some teaching from his dad, and I believe there was some primary schooling also, yeah, in okay. the area, but that would have been supplemented through, particularly through his father.
Yeah. So after primary schooling, he goes to college, and he did this at a pretty early age. Am I correct?
That's right.
And how young was he at the time?
Oh, I think he was 13 or so. So he's actually graduating from Yale when he's about 16, 17, he's finishing up. That was not quite as unusual then.
Okay.
Basically, you went to college when you were ready. It wasn't so much an age-based system as it was a matter of how far you had progressed, particularly in the Greek and Latin.
Okay.
And there are other references at Harvard that when you would get sort of tested in your languages, and when you were sufficiently versed in the languages, then you would be sent up.
Oh, okay. All right. So he 13 years old. He's off to college in Connecticut on his own. He's 3-4 years there at Yale. Did he have career goals in mind at this time? I mean, his grandfather, as you said, Solomon Stoddard, was a big deal in preaching, and his dad was a preacher. So was this what he had his mindset on? I'm going to be a preacher? Or was he one of these rebellious children who said, no, I'm going to go do something else, become an accountant or something?
Well, I think it's important to put into the foreground his conversion experience, which really altered his entire life and worldview, and that's recounted within the course of just about a paragraph in a document called The Personal Narrative, which he didn't publish during his lifetime. It was found among his papers at the time of his death. But that really, it seems that experience put him in a different direction. But if we look at the different bits of literary evidence, he wrote this spider letter, this fascinating letter of natural science, or I guess we'd call it biological science, of observing how spiders moved. And it was such an intricate set of observations together with diagrams showing how they would move long distances by shooting out filaments and then swinging in between, the pieces of filament. I was sent off to the scientific society for possible publication. So that indicates something about him, that he's observing nature and something. Maybe he had an inclination toward being a naturalist. And then there are these references to his writing ambitions and talks about how before he published in London, he wanted to publish in Boston first. That would have been the ambition. He considered himself a British, citizen, and London was certainly the center of the intellectual world for someone living in the colonies in North America. So he had this ambition, but then his conversion experience drew him into this lifelong preoccupation with what you can only call the beauty of God. He was not so much driven by duty as he was drawn by beauty. It was just the sheer spiritual beauty of God that drew him in and captivated him. He started keeping these notebooks that ran into many, many volumes ultimately, but the very first line in the very first notebook is that holiness is a beautiful and a lovely thing. By holiness, he meant a quality of God, a quality also that was imparted by God to the human soul. And in some sense, it was also a quality of the natural world. If you read The Personal Narrative, he said he saw traces of God's beauty in the streams, in the trees, in the atmosphere, in the hillsides around him. So some have compared him to the transcendentalists, to Ralph Waldo Emerson, or maybe even someone like John Muir, who referred to the Sierras, the forests out west, as a sort of natural temples of God. So there's a way in which Edwards was able to connect personal experience with the spiritual world, with the natural world, and see them all as connected. But that that doesn't really get underway until he's had this moment of great revelation, insight, that we would call his conversion.
How old was he at the time?
He's about 20 years old. We don't have the exact date, but it was a very distinct experience, and Edward's the only person I know who was converted by a doxology. He says that he was reading in the scripture text, and it said in 1 Timothy, to the only King our God be, you know, glory, honor, dominion, now and forever. And he said as he read these words, he felt that the glory of the divine being was diffused through his soul, and that he wanted to be caught up with God forever. It's very, you know, there's a kind of a private, solitary character to his spirituality, too, because a lot of his deepest experiences seem to happen when he was alone.
Mm-hmm.
You compare him, for instance, like to St. Augustine, who wrote his famous Confessions. Augustine's always with somebody. You know, he's talking about, you know, his relationship with his mother, and then his friend Alupius, and then his mistress later, and it's always relational. Edwards is a little bit more of a solitary type of individual.
Hmm. And he's trained at Yale as a naturalist, and he experiences his conversion when he's maybe in his late teens, early 20s or so. You mentioned that he graduated from Yale when he was pretty young, 17-ish or so. And he graduated at the top of his class, too, which, again, you know, for somebody right. that age, you know, wow, that's pretty good. But again, people were going to Yale at that age, and so on. You can see that. What happens after he graduates? And so there must have been a time there before his conversion, but after he finished Yale, what was he doing?
Well, he went for a time to live with his parents, and that was not a happy period from him because he was not a very regular notebook, or excuse me, diary keeper through most of his life, but he did keep a diary during that period, and he talks about vexation of spirit. Well, why? He's a young man, and he's gone back to mom and dad. It's really kind of feeling that itch that most young men and women have about that age of wanting to get off on their own. And so he's sort of rescued from that by this call to go and to serve this small parish of a congregation of Presbyterians in New York City.
Okay.
So he goes off to New York City at that point. But there is an interim, too, where he's And it's funny, he has his writing there. He says, I do have much cause to love and respect my parents. It's like he's trying to convince himself. It's clear that he's irritated at them. He maybe is a little bit proud of his own intellectual and spiritual attainments, even as a young man, kind of thought, looked down on them a little bit. He admitted in even his later years that he had a tendency toward spiritual pride. He referred it as the serpent that would rise up inside of him that he had to knock down again and again. So I think he recognized his own tendency to, he held himself to high standards, and he expected other people to as well, and could be kind of somewhat proud of his own attainments.
Well, he has that intellectual hubris. That might come from being at Yale, and he might look down on those folks from Harvard, so who knows. And he does. It's interesting that he moves back in with his parents. I think many of our college graduates today can relate to that.
Yes, the returning young adult phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly. So he might have kicked that whole thing off, though. One of the other things that he did during this period of time, I gathered from your book as well, was that he was invited back to Yale to be their senior or lead tutor there. And he wrote during this time he was violently beset with temptation. What's going on there?
Well, I think George Marsden and his biography Edwards suggest, and I think that we can't know for certain, but it seems it may have been sexual in nature. He was reading a book that dealt with, temptations that young men have to lust and at that time, now it would have not have been completely unusual reading material at that point, but he has it checked off on his list of books. So he read that about that time. And what's interesting that Marsden notes is that these references to this sort of his mind beset with temptation, those disappear as soon as he marries Sarah Pierpont. And so it does seem there's some kind of connection then. So it seemed like he had some struggle there, but he you know, like most people's age, he would not have described this in detail. He probably even had he been keeping a diary for longer than he did.
Now, you'd mentioned that, you know, he's somewhat filled with pride at various points in time. He writes about this as something that he has to tamp down. He has these violent fits with temptation, as he writes in his own diaries as well. What else do we know about Edward's overall temperament? Was this kind of a mellow guy? Was he a volatile figure? Who was he psychologically?
Well, he was a person that did not form friendships quickly. Those friends that he had, he held on to for a long time. Of course, they're really, if some biographers have pointed out, he didn't have friendships, any that endured from his childhood onward, because I think he was so much in a league of his own, intellectually speaking. I think it was, you know, hard for him to connect with people around him. He wasn't particularly good at small talk. His grandfather, Solomon's daughter, was a famous talker. You know, he could sit down and talk to anybody, you know, of any social class and background, churchgoer, non-churchgoer. Edwards didn't seem to have those kinds of gifts. He was very fortunate in the woman that he married, because Sarah, in many ways, was his social connection to the world. So I think it's hard to picture what Edward's life would have been like. He would have been living kind of a monastic, scholarly life of a solitary, almost, perhaps even somewhat reclusive, had it not been for Sarah and her influence. But she was much better at interfacing with the world at large.
I just want to ask one thing too about the Yale interlude. As after he graduates, he comes back as the head tutor or lead tutor, what they called it at the time. What kind of job would that be? And was that pretty common for somebody, say, 18, 19, 20 years old to be a lead tutor at Yale?
Well, this is a newly formed college struggling to establish itself as the competition to Harvard at that time.
Okay.
Of course, Yale greatly surpassed Harvard later on, as any Yale graduate could tell you.
Of course, yes.
But at this point, Yale is struggling, and so he's the graduate teaching assistant, and so the graduate student brought back to do teaching, and certainly there was a financial element to that of being able to, you know, having to be able to afford to provide instruction. And the college was going through a time of trial, because there was some debate between for a while the campus wasn't centered in New Haven. It was in Wethersfield. It was sort of moved back and forth between different locations. So it wouldn't have been completely unusual, but Edwards, because of his temperament, his scholastic and his contemplative temperament, he did not take very well to the administrative duties that were a part of the position that he had as a tutor at Yale. And he says in his personal narrative that he had no idea what a burdensome world it was until he became a tutor at Yale, because it sounded like he was constantly consumed with, you know, dealing with discipline cases and trying to maintain order with a somewhat unruly student body. We have accounts, of course, of student pranks. Students have been students for centuries, and so same kind of shenanigans that you'd find on a, you know, state U today were going on back then. And Edwards, it was a burden for him to try to keep order.
Yeah, so he lasts in that job, I guess, for about a year, and then he's off back home for a little bit, and he takes on the pastorate at Northampton Church, where his grandfather had preached. Did his father preach there as well?
No.
Okay.
So he skipped a generation there.
Okay, so
it's through his mother's side rather than his father's side. This is so his mother's father, or Solomon's daughter.
So how did he get connected with that church? There must have been that lineage connection there that says, well, man, your dad or your grandfather was Solomon Stoddard, and we think you're going to be great here as well. But he starts this position at age 23. Is that correct?
I believe that is right. No. It's about 20. He's about 26, he's a little bit. Slightly older, yeah. Slightly
okay, older. But still, I mean, I kind of think of that, and a few years ago, I had the first experience of having a pastor who was actually younger than me, and that was a challenge. I mean, just to, you know, I usually think of pastors as somebody who's older with wisdom, and then all of a sudden, when somebody's 10 years younger than you, you're like, whoa, and he's coming into this job when he's 26. So, what is his life there like in the Northampton Church?
Well, it's extremely rigorous, because the standards, and you may be right. Yeah, I think you are right. I've been thinking 1726. He is about 23. He's about to turn 24. It was a very, very rigorous life. In fact, the diary trails off at this point, and there's only one entry for a period of about 2 to 3 years. And it's quite funny what it is. He says, and this is the only thing he wrote, I think that Christ has recommended rising early from bed each day by rising early from the grave on Easter morning. So essentially, if you read between the lines, what he's basically saying is, I got to get up at like, you know, 3, 4 a.m., you know, to get everything done each day, because he was expected to give as many as 3 messages every week, you know, give a public lecture and then 2 sermons. And he was working really hard in preparation. This was high-level intellectual stuff. We don't tend to think of preaching that way today. I think our preachers are supposed to crack jokes, and today many wear blue jeans and kind of come down and speak on the level of the congregation, break it down, make it simple. But in those days, people, the sermons were long, and they were elaborate intellectual discourses. So you think of like a professor giving a, you know, an hour-long talk on some topic, or hour-and-a-half-long talk. That would be a lot of prep time. And so he was working really hard to do that, and we know that he went through a period where he had a breakdown for a while, where he couldn't work for some months because of overwork.
Wow.
His health was always kind of frail, so we see even early on that he was working very hard.
I have a question about this, too, because I'm always fascinated about this time in history. We think about it as a very spiritually alive time in American history, and, you know, we're going to be approaching the First Great Awakening here in a decade or two. How did those, what I would call a high theology sermon, connect with the general population? I mean, were people really connected into this? I mean, this is a time when you got a lot of farmers who, not everybody is always literate. Maybe Northampton is more like a bedroom community today filled with illiterate individuals, but not everybody could have been counted on as literate. And how was he received as the pastor there?
Well, you have to remember that on a global basis, that, you know, New England, and it's certainly in the 17th century, some decades earlier, it actually had the highest per capita concentration of college graduates of any community in the world.
Mm.
So there was no community, comparable community in Europe. To be a college graduate in, you know, in England, a Cambridge or Oxford graduate, I mean, there was a tiny number in relation to the population. You had a lot of Cambridge graduates, more Cambridge than Oxford, of course, that came over to New England. So, and you have that early New England culture that really is a book culture. It's book oriented. It's literary. Now, they didn't have the New York Review of Books. They didn't have Barnes and Noble. They didn't have the range of many of the titles, of course, that are published early on are theological. And so, there's a fascinating story from Cromwell's period in England of someone who was visiting from the continent, and he heard the soldiers in Cromwell's army, and they were debating predestination. And it wasn't just like a 5-minute debate. They went into intricate detail and went into like a 2-hour-long debate. And he was just stunned that ordinary soldiers would know that much about theology. So I think you might be surprised how many farmers were amateur theologians of their own. And the other thing that raised the bar, I think, in terms of the expectations in Northampton is that Stoddard had, for decades, you know, he's had a very long ministry of about 50 years, or actually almost 60 years in one location. And he was known for being a very, you know, very thorough preacher of Scripture. And so the people of Northampton were well known, even throughout New England, for being very well grounded in theology and in Scripture and so on. And that was considered important, of course, in those days. It was also the entertainment of the week. That may sound strange, but that it was the most interesting thing to do on a Sunday morning was to go and hear what Pastor so-and-so had to say.
That is interesting, and I can somewhat I gather that his mental breakdown would probably be due to the fact that he had to work very hard to keep up with the standards that his grandfather set in that time as well. So
now, as Edward's life is progressing, some people call this the sort of the transition from Puritan to Yankee. There is more of a secular culture that's developing. You see this at Harvard beginning in the 1700s. Harvard was founded really as a theological seminary, and it becomes more and more of a finishing school for young men of quality, young men who are being trained kind of to become up, be part of the Boston mercantile elite. So that sort of Yankee element is entering in, and there's an element of that in Northampton that's maybe not as obvious, but the river gods, as they called them, they're the men that are the large landowners in Northampton, are becoming more influential relative to the pastors. The pastors' authority is diminishing a little bit, and there's some controversies that begin to emerge in the community. Some girls getting pregnant And there's one case where Edwards wanted this young man to marry the young girl that he got pregnant. There wasn't any dispute about the case. And the family settled, made their own arrangement that didn't involve the marriage of the two. And so that's kind of a sign that pastoral authority is beginning to diminish, because a generation or two before, probably Edwards would have had his way in that particular case.
That is a really interesting environment to understand what he would be going through theologically, as well as thinking through mm-hmm. what is happening to him historically. Now, he spends 23 years as the pastor of Northampton, and I'm sure his weekly preparation for these sermons really gets him thinking and really starts to develop his theology, which is largely what your book is about. And one of the main questions that your book takes up is whether or not Edwards had a consistent theology throughout his life, or whether or not he changed in substantial ways, perhaps as he aged, or perhaps in response to the environmental context in which he was in and how that was changing. Now, you identify a number of periods or turning points in Edwards' life that correspond to events that are happening around him and things that are happening in his own personal life as well. So we're here at this point in his life. He's in his 20s and 30s, spending his time as the pastor of Northampton. What is he thinking about theologically, and what is going on around him at the time?
Well, let's see. He began, and if you even go before Northampton to the New York pastor, the early sermons have a kind of youthful glow and optimism. There's one of the sermons on Christ as the light of the world, and it's a wonderful text. It's just that sort of glows with this warm sense of, you know, how wonderful it is to be a follower of Christ, to be living in his presence every day. And that's, you know, that continues in the early Northampton period. And the first major turning point, and this is one of the original elements in our book on the theology of Jonathan Edwards, this idea of a number of distinct turning points. But the first turn is into this empirical analysis of religious experience. And that comes from the so-called Little Awakening that happened in Northampton in 1734 and 35. This is a period when the young people had become very restless and rebellious. They were addicted, as he called it, to night walking, basically carousing at night. And again, there was, some drunkenness and some sexual activity among young people. And to Edwards' surprise and to everyone's, Edwards took aside a group of the kind of the ringleaders, young people, and talked to them. And they basically listened to him and said, "You're right, we'll stop doing that." And so they began to become more serious, as he put it, about, you know, religious things. And then there were a couple of deaths of young people that took place. And that seemed to be the trigger to this youth movement that began and then spread into the senior generation. And over the course of several months, there was this intensification of religious experience that took hold. And several hundred people reportedly had a first-time conversion experience, and this was very, very unusual. In fact, John, you know, Wesley read the account of it in England, said, this is amazing. We haven't seen anything like this since the time of the apostles, where kind of a whole, not just an individual experience of conversion, but a whole community goes mm-hmm. through conversion. In many ways, his faithful narrative, 1737, was the first full-scale revival narrative. So that's the first turning point. And Edwards brought to these revivals a kind of clinical analysis in which he would write down very detailed accounts, almost like a psychoanalyst or a PhD psychologist analyzing experience. There's some who say that Edwards laid the foundation for the psychology of religion in America. William James, later the great Harvard psychologist of religion, looked back to Edwards as the first person who really did careful empirical study. So that's the first thing and that on his theological agenda, really, that emerges during his 30s, and that comes out of the community experience.
I want to stop you there, because there's an interesting tension that I noticed as you were just talking, and I also picked this up in your book. As you mentioned, his early sermons were a lot about beauty, and you could see this just, you know, outpouring of emotion and wonderment and awe, going back to how spiders moved and what he sees around him. But yet you talk about how he has this clinical analysis of these experiences. There seems to be somewhat of an interesting tension there. Do you pick that up at all?
Well, yeah, you mean sort of the spectator and participant.
Mm-hmm.
Edwards was adept at moving back and forth between different kinds of analysis. handle on the whole of Edwards, you know, the vastness. I mean, 73 volumes online, the Yale University Press website, 35,000 pages of text. But, you know, he analyzed the world symbolically using types and seeing analogies. He did biblical exegesis. He did very deep metaphysical, philosophical writing. But there definitely is a contrast. I don't know if it's a tension, but between his empirical analysis, his almost dispassionate recording of other people's experiences, with his very passionate, deeply involved records of his own experience. And ultimately, of course, you know, those weren't completely separate, because he sees his own awakening. It gives him at least some hints into what others are experiencing. But Edwards was a good enough analyst that one of the things he concluded was that conversion and spiritual experience happen in a variety of different ways. It can't be forced into one single model. And this is kind of contrary to the stereotype of Edwards, which is this sort of very narrow, you know, people have thought of him as this judgmental person. But in fact, he opened things up in a way to say, you know, if we actually look at experience, we find that different people have different kinds of experiences of God.
Now, this period of time in his life is where he develops this idea about affections. Mm-hmm. And that was one thing I read in your book, and I didn't quite understand that. You pose it as different than emotion. So what are the affections, and what is Edwards thinking about at this time?
Well, an affection is a disposition, an inclination of the self that is directed in a particular way. For instance, if I just say, I feel, you know, I'm feeling something, then I'm not necessarily, my feeling doesn't have to be, I could just say I'm feeling good or I'm feeling bad. It doesn't have to be directed anywhere. If I say I have affection, you would ask me the question, affection toward what or whom, right? It's affection is directional. And so what Edwards thought was that his analysis of scripture was that when the Bible talks about the heart, it's talking about a whole group of our basically inclinations and affections, that some of us are inclined toward money, we may be inclined toward sensual pleasure, maybe inclined toward intellectual pursuits, toward athletics. And Edwards, following the great tradition, going back to Augustine, the early church, thought that our affections were the truest indicator, really, of who we are. Augustine had said that love, he used the word love, but he says love is the gravity of the soul. And basically, if your love is earthly toward earthly things, you'll be held down. If your love is heavenly, you'll be carried up by your love. I think Edwards looked at it that way as well. So what is it that drives you? What keeps you awake at night? What are you thinking about when you wake up in the morning, thinking about when you go to bed at night? Is it a person? Is it an ambition that you have? Something you want to possess materially?
Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of is interesting. You can see him, you know, thinking about how these passions are being stirred and people are being changed during this awakening or revival in 1934 and 35. One of the interesting things, though, is that awakenings usually have a sunset. They usually tend to go to sleep after a while, and maybe in the middle of them you think they're going to last forever, but they don't. This awakening subsides in 35, and how does that affect Edwards?
Oh, well, this has a big effect on Edwards, and a big effect historically, because Edwards became much more cautious. And, you know, it's during the revival, of course, he's just glowing with optimism, because he sees people coming forward at the meetings, and their faces are beaming or radiant with the experiences they've had of God. And Edwards was always cautious about letting lay people, kind of having the open mic, as we would put it today, or letting people just stand up and speak about their experiences. He realized the danger of that. But there were not people talking about what they're experiencing. Edwards was picking that up, and they were coming in droves, of course, to his office to talk with him about their experiences. But then he saw many of these same people really fall into spiritual indifference and apathy, and some of them were, in his judgment, worse off after the revival than they'd been before. So what that meant is that when the Great Awakening came in 1740 and 41, Edwards had a much more I don't know if it's ambivalent, but more of a cautious attitude toward it than some of the so-called new lights that really got caught up in the excitement, and they thought, oh, this is just great. It's, you know, all of New England's going to be converted. And So Edwards, in the end, defends revival, but he thinks that you have to look over the long haul. Mm-hmm. That if there isn't, if someone has, you know, goes to a church and they come out and say, I've had this amazing experience for God, then basically say, you wouldn't say, well, that, I don't believe you, but you'd say, okay, well, let's talk about it in a week. Let's talk about it in a month. Let's talk about it in a year and then see what the fruit of the experience is. See what lasting changes. Again, in terms of affections, if someone says, I've had a great experience, you know, I've been a materialistic businessman and now I realize I want to start living for other people, you kind of have to see if that pans out in their practical experience. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it does, of course, and sometimes it doesn't. So it's sort of a wait-and-see approach.
Now, as you mentioned, the Great Awakening that everybody tends to be familiar with is in 1740, 41. We often at times associate that with George Whitefield. Give us your assessment. Do you think this Northampton revival was a precursor of things to come? And how did Edwards interact with Whitefield, if at all?
Oh, okay. Those are good questions. And you know, I don't think we mentioned this earlier, but I actually edited the Encyclopedia of Religious Revivals in America, and that was my big project before doing the Edwards book. So I had done with some work on revival. Edwards greatly appreciated Whitefield's preaching gifts, and of course Whitefield was just a phenomenal, you know, preacher, one of the really great preachers really in the history of Christianity, certainly the history of the modern church. The greatest stage actor in London said of Whitefield, said, this man can make the multitudes weep with the way he pronounces the word Mesopotamia. And then, you know, the other thing about Whitefield, of course, is his phenomenal ability just even physically to project his voice. You know, Ben Franklin in America heard that he was preaching to 20,000 people at a time. Of course, this is without amplification. He didn't believe it until Whitefield came to Philadelphia. And then Ben Franklin did his own estimate of the crowd size. He said there were 15,000, he estimated, or more, that heard Whitefield, and they were on both sides of the Delaware River in downtown Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So Whitefield was just a phenomenal person. He came to Northampton, and they had an impact on one another. Whitefield was as much impressed with Sarah Edwards as with Jonathan, and he wrote in his own diary that meeting Sarah caused him to renew his own prayers that God would send him a wife, because he saw her as a wonderful helpmeet, to use the traditional language, for Jonathan, and he saw the relationship they had, and he thought, gosh, I'd like to be married to someone like that. So it's really kind of a testimony to Sarah. And then when Whitefield preached in the Northampton church, we know from one eyewitness account that Edwards wept. He wept through the sermon. He was deeply affected by it. And then there was something of a little bit of a rift between the men that took place later, because Whitefield was ready to follow subjective impulses. He would have a sense like, you know, I need to go and preach in the city or do this or do that. And Edwards was cautious about that. You might say, to put in contemporary terms, that Whitefield was a little bit more Pentecostal. He believed a little bit more in sort of the moment by moment leading of the Holy Spirit. Edwards was more cautious, and he took Whitefield aside and he cautioned him on this. And then Edwards himself wrote later that Whitefield became a little cool toward him, did not confide in him quite as much after that. I mean, it's clear that the two men respected one another, but there was a little bit of a difference between them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting tandem and a kind of interesting pairing of personalities at that point in time in history. One of the other turning points that you mentioned comes right after the Great Awakening of the early 1740s, and this is what you call the ethical rigorous turn in Jonathan Edwards' life. What is going on there?
Well, this is coming out of an even greater spiritual letdown that happened in the late 1730s. In the late 1730s, there is a letdown. Edwards preaches on the wise and the foolish virgins. This is out of the Gospel of Matthew. And it's clear he's kind of saying, look, you may have had a great experience in the awakening in Northampton, but you've got to be living, you know, day by day, living out as a Christian disciple. And what happens in this so-called ethical, what we call ethical rigorous turn, is he becomes even more explicit about that and wants to really insist on a higher standard of, you know, of Christian life. And, you know, Edwards set high standards. He expected people really to be living a life in which the concerns of God took priority in their heart over other things. One major critique of Edwards that I would have, and I think George Marston in his biography shares this, is that Edwards you know, he may have simply expected too much of people, and that, or Perry Miller said that his congregation got tired of feeling deficient.
Yeah.
They felt like they couldn't, you know, live up to his standards. So I think Edwards, he felt most at home when he was with other people who shared his sort of uncompromising standards. It'd be kind of like, you know, going, it's like, I think I'll go for a bike ride with, you know, maybe with Lance Armstrong. Okay, you're going to go for a bike ride with Lance Armstrong. You're going to have to try to keep up. You know, he's not going to go at half speed just so you can feel good about being alongside of him. So Edwards is a sort of spiritual, intellectual athlete in that sense. He was driving himself to the highest level.
Yeah, I can imagine with Lance Armstrong, even though you get a bit of encouragement in the first few miles there to keep up, you're like, yeah, I'm feeling good about this. I'm with Lance Armstrong. But, you know, at mile 15 or 20, you're like, oh, right, dude, right, is this ever going to end?
Heartbreak kill. Yeah, Lance is way out ahead, and he's probably not going to look back. So that's a little bit. And so that's something, you know, there are different kinds of pastors, or some pastors are more driven. I guess the ideal church, you've got some balance of different personalities. But he was definitely not the pastor who's going to just hold your hand and say, it's okay to be where you're at right now. He was going to be pushing himself and pushing others around him.
And so then during the 1740s, you mentioned a few other turns that he have, and it seems to culminate around the fact that he's getting much more ethically rigorous here. You talk about his ecclesial sacramental term, which is then followed shortly thereafter by the Calvinistic controversial term. So you can kind of see all this building up to something that's going to happen in the Northampton Church. So fill us in the 1740s, the middle and the latter part of that decade.
Well, yeah, then that's certainly a very critical period in Edward's life. The real difficult and ultimately kind of heartbreaking transition was related to the Lord's Supper. Solomon Stoddard, the grandfather who had preceded Edwards in the pastorate at Northampton, had took a very unusual view of the Lord's Supper, because virtually all of the Puritans at that point, with together almost all Protestants, you know, Lutheran, Reformed, or Calvinistic, believed that the Lord's Supper, preaching was for everybody. You could invite non-Christian people to come in and hear God's word to be preached, but the Lord's Supper was for committed disciples, committed followers. Solomon Stoddard had a conversion experience, in his own account, when he came to the Lord's Supper. And so he became convinced, contrary to the whole tradition of others around him, that the Lord's Supper was what he called a converting ordinance. It was a practice that was designed, on the one hand, for people who already committed disciples, but non-Christian people could be invited to take it, and in a way to maybe to come to a new experience of God's grace through it. That would be an unusual view even today in more conservative, you know, Protestant circles. So, Edwards, it's not clear whether he was ever completely comfortable with it, but I think with the stature of his grandfather and his own theological views weren't really formed, he kind of went along with this. And what that meant was that a lot of people were coming to take the Lord's Supper at the church that hadn't really made any clear profession of faith. They had kind of grown up in, you know, in the shadow of the church. Mm-hmm. But hadn't clearly identified that they were definitely committed to it. And as the 1740s went on, he became more and more convinced that he needed to return to the stricter practice of. And it's not true. There's a misunderstanding that Edwards insisted that everyone needed to have a dateable conversion experience. You know, on such and such a day, I first experienced God's grace. That's not true. But what Edwards framed was just a very basic statement that one really believed oneself to be an object of God's grace, and so some kind of specific declaration of personal faith was the requirement that he wanted to implement. And there was a huge pushback against that, because what was happening was you had kind of the hereditary assumption. We have this in some churches today, where if your grandfather was the pastor, you know, then you're assumed to be a member, and that sort of passes through families from generation to generation. And so that controversy is what ultimately led to the primary thing that led to his dismissal in 1750 from his pastor, the controversy over the terms of acceptable terms for receiving communion.
Now, is this what the Arminian controversy is all about? Because I've heard that term so many times, that people are arguing about Arminianism, and I always get lost when that's occurring. Well, or is that a different controversy?
No, that's different. And this relates to the question, I mean, to go back ultimately to the great paradox, and I don't think most theologians feel that the paradox can ultimately be resolved of God's sovereignty and human freedom.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if someone says, I believe in Christ, is it that they believe in Christ through a turning of their own will, and then God's grace began working in their life? They sort of opened the door for Christ to come into their life. That would be more of the Arminian view. The Calvinistic view is if someone says, I believe in Christ, it's a sign that God already was working in their heart. And that, is, of course, relates back to the whole mystery of predestination, this idea that some are chosen and some are not. Calvinists say that's the eternal mystery of God. We don't know why. It's unconditional. Just God says some are chosen, some are not chosen. The Arminian says, no, God looks into the future. He foresees those who are going to make this free decision, because Arminians emphasize freedom, and chooses some people based on their foreseen faith.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's just the surface level, because it gets, of course, much more technical and complicated when you get into all the specifics.
Yeah, no, I've wrestled with this and the free will issue many times, and it still is one of those things that just gets my head spinning here. Does this factor into his dismissal in 1750 from his congregation as well?
Well, not so much. It does figure into his writing. That wasn't really the presenting issue. The presenting issue was... with this issue of the communion, and there's another issue I maybe should bring up, the so-called bad book. There were, and this gets you into all the details. You know, if you get deal of church controversy, you end up learning maybe more than you even want to know. But
yeah,
the all the available land was being taken up by the landholders, and so you had this whole generation of young men growing up that, and they were already getting in their mid and late 20s. And according to the customs of the time, they couldn't marry until they had land of their own. They're sexually frustrated young men. They want to be married. They want to move on with their lives. And they're kind of waiting for a family member to die off or to inherit or something. And a bunch of these men, young men, found this gynecological manual that had illustrations of female body parts that gave them knowledge that they would not otherwise have had in this culture at this time. And they used this to taunt some of the young women. We would today call it a sexual harassment case.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no question community that that this was very objectionable to everyone. But Edwards made some major pastoral blunders. He sent out this call, this summons for people to show up to testify about it, and he didn't distinguish the young men who were actually accused of harassing the girls from those who were just called upon to testify about it. And this really alienated many of the leading families in North End, because they saw their sons' names, on this list.
Yeah.
And so that there was a sort of combustible mixture of this whole this anger over the way that he had handled the so-called bad book episode, and then the communion thing is, okay, now you're telling us that we've got to make some special profession of faith that we didn't have to make before we can come to communion. And that just sort of, things reached a boiling point. But the Arminian thing was kind of going on in other places in New England. When Edwards began writing against so-called Arminianism, he was addressing more of the issue elsewhere rather than an issue in his own backyard.
Yeah, so he has the deep theological debates that are going on that are attracting an intellectual crowd. But again, most church divisions are not necessarily over theology, but can be over, who you call out, as we found out in this bad book incident. So he gets kicked out of his congregation in 1750. Does this have an impact on him? Does it sour him? Does it change the way he thinks about things? You mentioned that this is kind of another turning point, which you call the cultural historical turn. So what happens in the 1750s?
Well, it's a traumatic change. In those days, I mentioned like Stoddard for about 60 years at one church. A man was considered almost married to his congregation. To be turned out like that, it would be kind of like being divorced. And Edwards is in his 50s, and he's considered too old to be called to another parish. There wasn't any provision in those days for ministers readily to move from one place to the other. And he says he wrote to his friends in Scotland, who are watching with great concern. And they even at one point offered to find him a parish that he could take in Scotland. And he just said, I'm too old to make that transatlantic transition. That would have been a different culture, crossing the Atlantic by sea with his family. But he said at one place, I'm cast upon the great ocean of this world and know not whither I should go with my innumerable charge, meaning all of his children that he was responsible to care for. So this is a very difficult transition. But what came out of this was a unusual opportunity to go and to be what today we call missionary, to work. Well, actually, he was a pastor among whites that were living in on the frontier. Now, the frontier at this point isn't somewhere in Kansas. It's actually western Massachusetts. It's the frontier.
Right.
And so he's in the Stockbridge, which is a frontier community with, you know, kind of a stockade, you know, built around it because of the possibility of Indian raid. And he encounters Native Americans there, and he is responsible to be speaking to them. He never, because of his age, he encouraged his son to learn the Native American languages, the Mohican, but he didn't learn it himself. He spoke through interpreter. But this encounter with non-Christian, a living non-Christian religion that most people in England would have had, really drove Edwards into this final turn of his life in which he started really studying non-Christian religions in depth. And there's only a limited amount of information available in his day. He read about the, you know, Chinese religions and Buddhism and Hinduism as much as he could find. And he was convinced, and this is surprising to some people, though, given his Calvinistic theology, is that God was really working in the various religious traditions of the world. He never gave up his focus on Jesus Christ as the center. But he thought that God had a plan that somehow to work through the different religions of the world to bring glory to himself. And that the non-Christian religions had at least elements, they had elements of truth, elements of wisdom within them that he as a Christian theologian could affirm.
Mm-hmm. A very, very modern outlook on, I guess, comparative religions, as you would say.
Gerry McDermott, my co-author, was the person that really broke this story, so to speak, because he found this in the notebooks, and no one had really looked at it before. But Edwards did more study of comparative religions than anyone else in colonial America.
Hmm. Setting off a whole new field of study, I guess. Now, you mentioned that he's a missionary, and we've talked about him being a preacher. And at the beginning of the podcast, I read a statement from your book where you also talked about him as an activist. How would you characterize Edwards as an activist throughout his life?
Well, he was very involved in itinerant preaching during the time of the Awakening. In fact, arguably his greatest impact was outside of Northampton during the Great Awakening. He's preached in Suffolk. He actually presided over some pretty wild worship services, which people were falling to the ground, crying out, something kind of like what later became called a Holy Roller service or a Pentecostal type of service where there's a lot of emotional outbursts. So he's preaching in different locations. He's being invited to different places. He was very involved in what we would later call prayer mobilization. He helped to implement in the USA something called the Concert of Prayer, which was a monthly day set aside for prayer. He believed that if God's people would come from different churches and even different continents, because it started in Scotland and then spread to the U.S., but if God's people in different regions and different congregations would all pray together and bring their petitions before God, that the great spiritual breakthroughs could come and the Christian message could advance. And of course, this becomes very important historically because out of the Concert of Prayer movement really emerged the modern mission, the Protestant missions movement. Not in Edward's lifetime, but more at the end of the 1700s, around just about 1800, William Carey, who's a British Baptist, who said that Edwards was like a second Bible to him. He was constantly reading Edwards, and he was inspired by Edwards to found the first Protestant mission society, which then sent him off as a missionary to India. That was unheard of at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But Edwards had a big impact in that respect. And then, of course, also among the Native Americans, he was an advocate for Indian rights. He stuck up for Indians, and there was an effort by some of the settlers to, as you unfortunately would expect, knowing the history of Native Americans, is to take their land from them, deprive them of opportunities for education. And so he was farsighted in that respect.
Yeah, so you can definitely see that he is on the cusp of many of these new trends that are coming, and one could only imagine that if he had lived a little bit longer, he might see some of these things come to fruition. But he does die at the end of the 1950s, and in a rather odd kind of way that when I read it was kind of surprising. He gets called off to Princeton, which I still think is called the College of New Jersey at the time,
right,
to become the president. First of all, how does he get called to do that? Is Princeton looking for some, you know, they put out an advertisement and say, we need an exiled preacher who knows something about spiders, please come to New Jersey? Or how does he get picked?
They had gone through some difficulties because they had lost their two earlier presidents had died quite in quick succession, and unfortunately the presidency of Princeton is becoming known as a kind of death trap, and then ironically, of course, Edwards comes and he dies within just a couple months of arriving. So, and so you wonder about the person who came after Edwards, of course.
Yeah, no thanks, I don't want the job.
Yeah. Edward's reputation was getting out at this point. His theological writings from the 1750s, particularly, you know, he did publish Freedom of the Will, had come out at that time. His Treatise on Religious Affections, which had come out in the end of the 1740s, that was well known. No one had any idea of the scope, the scale of his private notebooks. Because his published writings were, you know, a tenth as long as these private notebooks, and all the sermons, you know, he left behind 1,200 sermons, wow, sermon manuscripts. You know, St. Augustine left behind about 400 or 500, so Edwards just almost a category of his own. So this is why we have so many volumes in the published Yale edition of his work. So, but his reputation was rising toward the end of his life. And he you know, there's a story of him. He was not a man to show much emotion, but he wept, you know, when he was about to leave Stockbridge, and it's not clear exactly what the weeping was about, but I think he deeply appreciated the recognition that he was going to get. It wasn't clear that he really wanted to take on the administrative work. He was never interested, really, I think, in administration. In the letter that he wrote to the Princeton trustees, this is a very important historical document because it indicates that at the end of his life, he was going to work on this vast book that he called A History of the Work of Redemption. And he was very, very excited about it. He was going to synthesize and integrate everything that he had ever done in his whole writing career. All the private notebooks on scripture and the miscellaneous, the little topical essays that he wrote. It was all going to take the whole of all Christian theology and basically cast it in historical form as a historical narrative. Now, this is really interesting because this is a 20th century trend in theology, so narrative theology. Karl Barth, probably the most influential theologian of the 20th century, in some ways sort of promoted this, and there's some other trends at Yale University in the 20th century that in part inspired by Edwards. So Edwards, in another respect, not only the comparative religions, but this whole idea that theology is basically a story of God's interaction with humanity. Edwards was ahead of his time. Theology wasn't just a series of dry logical propositions one after the other. It was a narrative for Edwards. And he did agree to be president of Princeton, but he was reluctant because he was about to start writing his great History of Redemption.
And as we mentioned, shortly after arriving at Princeton, he dies, and his death is a little bit unusual. And for me, it's a little bit of a historical oddity because there was a smallpox outbreak in the region and people were advocating to get inoculated from smallpox, and he took the inoculation and it was a bad one, and it caused a reaction. His throat swelled up and he basically died. My question to you as a historian, I didn't think inoculations happened as early as the 1750s, 60s.
I believe the technology was taken over from some of the Native Americans, and wow, they would take the Native Americans had their own way, in effect, of inoculating, where they would remove a smallpox scab and then they would cut someone and they would take a little bit of the scab and put it on the surface. This is like kind of like folk medicine.
Yeah,
quite fascinating. And basically, that would introduce a small amount of the smallpox into someone's system, and then they would get basically a rash over their body that would quickly pass. They'd sort of get a mild version of it. So that's kind of like a form of inoculation. And what happened is that I think it was in the late 1600s that some of the New England Puritans, Cotton Mather, who was up in Boston, was one of the ones to be a promoter of inoculation. There was a lot of fear about this because people thought this was crazy, you know, to expose yourself to we describe today as microbes. They didn't, it wasn't fully understood then. But what Edwards was trying to do was to show people they had nothing to fear from the new technology. And what, unfortunately, they gave him a too large a dosage.
Yeah.
And then they actually had an antidote, but the doctor delayed in coming. So it's just really a whole series of things. And his throat swelled up so that he wasn't able to put the tube down his throat and to administer the antidote. So Edwards died with his great work unfinished, the great history of the work of redemption. Who knows what that, you know, that would have been like Thomas, St. Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica, one of the great theological works of all time that Edwards lived to write that. And Edwards, for a while, you know, for many generations, is known just for a few works. You know, the Freedom of the Will, his Calvinistic treatise, and then the one sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, which fortunately we haven't even mentioned that so far. But, you know, in popular culture, that's kind of the one sermon that people know about Edwards, which is unfortunate because, as I said, he left behind 1,200 sermon manuscripts. So there's such a kaleidoscope of different ideas in Edwards. And you know, I think Edwards had more to say about delight in God than about damnation or the loss of God. So,
yeah. Now, you know, looking back, and we just have a minute or two before we close up our interview here. But looking back on his life, and we have the benefit or the hindsight of looking at these, you know, 1,200 sermons and the voluminous amounts of private writing that he did. What has been his impact or legacy for us in contemporary times?
Well, he, Edwards, with his qualified and very intellectually deep defense of revival, he really sanctioned a place for vibrant, vital spiritual experience. And this is one of the things that's created a difference, I think, between the USA and arguably in Europe. The European Protestant traditions, which, of course, have been really in decline, you know, and the numbers shrinking in places like England, did not really embrace the kind of vibrant, vital, dynamic spirituality that the American church did. And you drive around America today, of course, we have a growing number of non-religious people in America. It's by no means certain where things are going to be, 15, 20, 30 years from now. But, you know, we have mega churches. We have, and we have churches that were, there really is this embrace of experience, that to know God and to be a Christian means to be in a vital, vibrant experience with God. And that, in some ways, that's a legacy from Edwards, because Edwards really named this, he analyzed it, he sanctioned it, he made it respectable and in a way.
Well, I think that is actually very good point to leave off on, because we've had a number of different podcasts here throughout our series, our more than 100 episodes here, that talk about the vibrancy of American religious landscape. And we can definitely see how Jonathan Edwards was a part of that. And Michael, I want to thank you for being a part of Research on Religion.
It's been good to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.